Welcome to AADL Reads. We had the pleasure of talking to New York Times bestselling author Sarah Vowell. She offers personal, often humorous accounts of everything from presidents and their assassins to colonial religious fanatics. Her most recent book is entitled Lafayette in the Somewhat United States. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Thanks for sitting down and talking with me today. For those listeners who haven't read your work, can you tell us a little bit about your most recent book, Lafayette in the Somewhat United States?
I'm sorry, I'm thrown because you're using podcast voice. Did you know that?
I didn't actually.
We were just talking and you sounded like a person. And now you sound like a person doing a podcast.
What a fraud.
I think I probably... Am I doing it still?
No, now you're talking like a person.
Because I do have a story time voice.
Yeah, that's probably my podcast voice,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
FYI, I'm older than 12, so you can just talk to me. What was your question? It was about my book.
Yes. Can you tell us a little bit about it? No spoilers, obviously.
It's supposed to be about the Marquis de Lafayette, who was a teenage French nobleman who came over in 1776 from France to volunteer with George Washington's army. But it kind of spins out from there. he was just this kid, and he was the richest orphan in France. And his father had been, he came from a long, long, long line of military heroes, like going back to the Crusades. And unfortunately for him, when he came of age, France was, alas, at peace for like 5 minutes, so he needed, you know, to get some war glory, he came over here. And, I mean, one of the reasons I started writing it was I went to Herman Melville's house in the Berkshires.
Did you?
Know? Yeah, not to brag. I'm just, this is just librarian pandering, I guess. But there was on display the dress Melville's wife wore as a baby when she was presented to Lafayette in 1825. He came back to America 50 years later. Yeah. And that's when I started researching his return trip to America as an older gentleman. He was invited by President Monroe kind of to gin up excitement for the 50th anniversary of the Revolution. And it was this huge, huge big deal, his trip to America. Like, the majority of the population of New York City showed up to meet his boat, and it was just this party in his honor every night for over a year. So at first I was just writing about that, and the thing that appealed to me was that he was this article of agreement. Like, you know, the sectional differences in this country in when he came back were already, you know, we were already on the road to the Civil War. But he was like this one thing that everyone could agree on.
Yeah.
And that seemed attractive to me. But once I dug into writing about this story, when I say it's partly about him, but it's also about how at every point in his story in America, both during the Revolutionary War and during his return trip in 1825, it's just all Americans bickering in the background. It's just, you know, like when his return trip was during the most rancorous presidential election in our history, and during the war, like, George Washington is always about to get fired by his supposed friends, and, you know, there's just, it's just, even though the thing that drew me to him was that Americans could agree on him, that was sort of rare, and, like, in through our whole history,
and still,
all we do is just bicker and argue and, you know, fight.
We hate to get along.
I mean, I think it's actually the beauty of this country. You know, we do kick ourselves a lot for our differences, but it's because we're free to have them and express them.
Yeah,
that we shouldn't take that for granted.
No, absolutely.
I love arguments, just as long as I'm not a part of one.
Mm-hmm.
While you were working on this book,
mm-hmm.
what were you reading, anything for inspiration, or were you trying to stay away from?
Inspiration. I'm a nonfiction author.
Right.
We don't read for inspiration. We we read to get the info we need, you know.
Right.
So, I mean, sure, I read, you know, every love. I read, you know, oodles of biographies and, you know, things like yeah. part of it is the book is about the French alliance and how, you know, we really couldn't have won that war without the money and help and material aid from the King of France.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I read books about his advisors and what they were telling him about helping the Americans. And they were basically saying, like, don't.
Right, yeah.
But the thing is, I mean, so much of history, especially where men are involved, is motivated by revenge, you know. So, like, Lafayette's father had been a soldier during the Seven Years' War, and he was killed by an English cannon. And so one of Lafayette's motivations for fighting the British was, you know, they killed his daddy.
Yeah.
And Louis XVI, the King of France, was still smarting from having to give up, you know, almost all of Canada to the British at the end of that war. So he hated the British, too. So he was mostly motivated just by, you know, the kind of ancestral loathing between France and Britain. So, I mean, it really ruined him helping us. It bankrupted France. There was a big depression, basically, and it ended up with, you know, eventually him getting his head cut off. So
right.
the advisors who were telling him, don't help these punks, were kind of on to something.
So I don't know how you feel about it, but I just want you to know. I'm picturing you, you know, writing this book and listening to, like, Hamilton on repeat.
Well, Hamilton didn't exist when I was working on this book. Well, I guess it must have existed in...
Right. It wasn't out yet.
Though. No, it wasn't out yet.
Gotcha. Dang. You just ruined my mental picture.
Right.
But that's okay.
It's more like, you know how... I mean, I love Hamilton, but
yeah.
you know how a lot of... the where my book is sort of heading is the Battle of Yorktown.
Yeah.
And in Hamilton, basically, like, Alexander Hamilton wins the Battle of Yorktown, and then we have a country. But
yeah.
I'm more like reading the diary of, you know, one of the sappers and miners, which are the guys who are digging the defensive trenches at Yorktown that partly, you know, helped the French and American forces get the British surrounded and get them to surrender.
Right.
Or, you know, going to Yorktown and talking yeah. to the park ranger who, you know, shows you around and, you know, talks about how there are more French soldiers and sailors at Yorktown than American ones. And
mm-hmm.
it was this big group effort, and it was mostly the French who won that.
You had some help, Hamilton.
Yeah. So mine is definitely less of a toe tapper, I guess.
Right.
But, you know.
Okay, before we continue.
I mean, it's actually, though, very, it's more moving in a way. I mean, you go to Yorktown battlefield and you see the French cemetery. You see how these Frenchmen gave their lives to help us build our country.
Yeah.
And then you can go across town for lunch and there's still freedom fries on the menu.
Yeah.
So, like, we're complete jerks and about, you know, how we really owe our country in large part to French help.
Yeah.
It's not as great of a story.
Well, I mean,
and Lafayette was basically bald, you know, which in the original cast of Hamilton, that was hardly the case.
Yeah. David Diggs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He has quite a head of hair.
A beautiful head of hair.
I can understand why people like that. I do, too. I just like the nitty-gritty, you
right.
know, all the, like,
the details.
All the little details, yeah.
Yeah. I appreciate that. Before we continue, how would you describe yourself as a reader? For example, like, I currently, because it always changes, right? I would currently say my reading is like an on-again, off-again lover,
mm-hmm.
if you will. How would you describe yourself?
I mean, it depends a lot, you know, when I'm researching a book, which is usually what I'm doing, there's a lot of work reading. So a lot of that is me. It's almost like I have a flashlight in my head and I'm just like looking for the thing I can use. So it's a very, I'm basically a vulture, whatever I read. It's like waiting for something to pop out at me.
Yeah.
And that's not always entirely pleasurable.
Right. You're like a business reader.
I mean, I think as a reader, more and more, maybe the last 20 years, the thing that I'm always most interested in is a sense of place. Mm-hmm. I really love geography and the way books take you to places. Sometimes that's nonfiction. Like, for instance, you know, the Japanese architect Arata Isosaki just won the Pritzker Prize. And so that made me, like, the other day go back to – he wrote this book called Japan-ness in Architecture. Mm-hmm. And there's this part where he talks about the condition of the post-war Japanese architect is basically trauma because of the war, but also because of all the natural disasters. Mm-hmm. But then there's this part where he talks about all this Japanese stuff. I mean, his book is called Japan-ness. But then at some point he's like, but being Japanese wasn't my only goal, you know. So he's still saying, I'm still a person. So I really love that kind of stuff. But I also love crime novels. Mm-hmm. And because, especially the series where you can really get to know a place. Like, yeah. I really like this Midwestern novelist. I guess you could call him a crime novelist. His name is William Kent Kruger, and he has this whole series about this ex-small-town cop named Cork O'Connor, and it takes place up in the Boundary Waters in Minnesota. And there's usually some kind of murder or something like that going on, but there's also, like, the other villain is the weather. You know, like, there'll be a snowstorm or, you know... there's a series of novels that take place on the Upper Peninsula. I think the author's name is Steve Hamilton, where, you know, like, Lake Superior is a villain, you know. I mean, like, Lake Superior is
it
no
really
joke,
is, to be honest.
You know. It's like a dangerous, brutal body of water. So
yeah.
I always like, I like those novels a lot. Also, they're kind of the only genre of literature where the loner is the hero. Like, in the rest of literature, it's all about, like, I mean, you're supposed to commune with other people.
Yeah.
But these novels, you know, starting, like, I love Raymond Chandler most of all, like Philip Marlowe, that kind of loner character. And the way a loner interacts with other people, you know, like going around trying to investigate what's going on. But I loved that Swedish crime novelist, Henning Mankell, where, you know, about the cop in small town Sweden. Just you get a sense for the place through these stories. You know, like, it's through those novels I was aware of the increasing tension in Northern Europe about migration, you know, because that sort of figures into some of his stories. And, like, there's this one novel, I forget the name of it, where an old woman dies and she's been attacked, and they think the word she says before she dies is foreigner, and that, like, gins up all this, you know.
Yeah.
That always brings out the best in people. So so I do like – I like those novels just because of that sense of place, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I just finished reading American Gods by Neil Gaiman.
Mm-hmm.
And that book is essentially, like – have you read it?
It's
him, like, traveling around all of the continental United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gave me this, like, I want to go to those places.
Yeah.
I've never heard of these places. And a lot of them are just, like, small towns that you would never hear of otherwise. But,
yeah,
like, I need to go there.
I know. I mean, that is a good feeling. Like,
yeah.
Right now I'm reading Pete Buttigieg's book.
I have it on hold.
Oh, you
currently.
Do? And, yeah, I guess the print copy sold out, but, it makes you, like, weirdly excited about South Bend.
Right.
It's like, I got to go to South Bend. This sounds like an exciting place.
Like, and I've been
even though he's really just talking about solving its pothole problem.
Right. Like, I've been to South Bend before. I have family that lives there, and I had, like, never thought twice about it. But I imagine after I read his book, when it comes in for me, there's, like, a super long wait list for it.
Yeah. But I mean, one of the things I'm really interested in is kind of spite, you know? Mm-hmm. Like how, like, the Japanese call it the Sea of Japan, but the Koreans who were, like, repeatedly conquered by the Japanese call it the East Sea, because they don't want to call it that. And, like, in Buttigieg's book, you can see why people just call him Mayor Pete.
Yeah.
He talks about some politician. I guess South Bend is weirdly multi-ethnic for white people. Like, there are a lot of Eastern European populations there.
Yeah.
And some politician made the mistake of complimenting a Polish civic group, complimenting their bratwurst instead of calling it kielbasa. Like, I love details like that, you know.
It's like up here in Michigan, we call it the Civil War. But down south, it's the War of Northern Aggression.
Yeah,
it's like that
that's
same
stupid,
thing.
But yeah.
What?
Yeah.
All right, so I'm just going to go into some random questions.
Okay.
What is the scariest book you've ever read?
I mean, I was very terrified as a kid by The Telltale Heart. Mm-hmm. Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, I had a very churchy childhood. The Bible is pretty scary in places, especially if you're a child, you know. Like, there's that part where God tells Abraham to stab his son, and he's willing to do it, and that's seen as a sign of Abraham's faith. But as a kid, you're just looking at your parents like, wait, let's talk this through, you know.
I'm like, dude gets eaten by a whale.
Or like, the apocalypse is a little worrisome.
What is the longest book you've ever read, either by length, time it took you to read, or it feeling long?
Well, I've been reading Infinite Jest for like 20-something years. I mean, the first really long book I read was Gone with the Wind. I don't think people read that anymore.
I haven't read it. A funny note about Infinite Jest.
Every single American used to read that book.
Yeah.
And now they don't. I mean, not that it's, it's a problematic book.
Right.
But it used to be one of those things. Have you seen the movie?
No.
Yeah. It used to be one of those things everyone knew about.
Yeah.
And there were lots of, but that was... I remember being congratulated by my seventh grade teacher that I was carrying that around, you know, because it is a very long book.
It is. I felt like I got my, like, badge of honor because I read, like, Moby Dick, which is also, like, a...
It's really not that long. I mean, every single word has a kind of import in that book. I mean, that's actually, in some ways, that's my favorite novel.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not that long, though. I think, I don't know, you might want to just lie on that. But that's the book where if I'm writing and I'm stuck, I can always just walk over to Moby Dick, crack it open, read something at random, and it reminds me of how much I love books.
Oh,
and
that's
I
beautiful.
Love language. But it's so strange. It's not like I'm going to come away from Moby Dick writing like Melville.
Right.
It's just like, oh, yeah, I love books. Yeah. Oh.
The magic of books.
But then, you know, I don't know about whether young people, like, I remember taking my nephew when he was about, I guess, 8. So that's one of my favorite books. And we were in Maui, and I took him to the Whaling Museum. And to me, like, whaling and part of that story is just so fascinating and physical and lusty and adventuresome. And this kid was an animal lover, and he walks into that, you know, Whaling Museum, and then he sees a harpoon. He reads what that's for, and he's like, wait.
Oh,
they
no.
killed whales.
Oh, no, sweetie.
And then it's like, yeah, they really killed whales.
He
just got so increasingly upset. And finally I was like, well, cheer up, you know, fossil, like petroleum is about to be discovered in Pennsylvania and the whole world will go crazy for fossil fuels. Yeah. And he's like, good,
yeah.
You know, because that means yeah.
they had to at the time.
Right, you know? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to read, you were going to read by whale oil.
Yeah. Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Kids are great.
Yeah. Or they're babies, I don't know.
Right. Yeah. What's your favorite book that no one else has heard of?
Have you heard of a book called Out of Sheer Rage?
No. So I think that's probably
this is a book by the English writer Jeff Dyer that is a book about how he can't write a book about D.H. Lawrence. It's kind of a busman's holiday for a writer where, you know, that's the story of every book being written, like, ugh, I can't write this book. And the whole book is the story of him trying to write a book about D.H. Lawrence and kind of failing.
That's so,
and it's full of, like,
meta.
procrastination and, you know, things like he's going to, I don't know where it was, Italy maybe, and he's going on a trip and he thinks, if I bring the complete poems of D.H. Lawrence, I'll never read it. But if I don't bring it, I'll need it desperately. These are, you know, the kind of things that nonfiction writers think about.
Right. I was going to, like, write down the title, but then I realized I can just, you know, listen back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The recorded technology is
it's amazing.
Pretty handy.
It's incredible. All right. Our last question. What are you reading right now, if anything?
Oh, well, I just mentioned I'm reading Mayor Pete's book.
Oh, yeah. You said that.
Yeah. I mean, I take notes when I read, of course. You know, in case I need to write about this later, there's this presidential election going on.
Yeah.
Like, here are some of my favorite quotes I've written down. Let's see. He talks about snow because he's the mayor of a town in Indiana. And he calls it the mortal enemy of any mayor it touches. But he says it can be a great unifier, which, you know, those of us who live in cold places know, like, that's the thing everyone has in common. We're all freezing. Like, there's this, he talks about, the beginning of the book is about this historical snowstorm in South Bend from before he was born, and how it snowed so much, and then, as just happened in my town last month, where it snowed so much, like, such an historical amount. At some point, the problem is, what are we going to do with all this snow? Like, my driveway, I just had to stop shoveling it, because I didn't have any place to put the snow anymore. So I just shoveled this one little desperate line out the front door that looked like a cry for help, you know. But apparently there was some stalled construction project everyone called the hole, where they just shoveled all the snow into this hole. Or Mayor Pina is kind of a nerd. Like, he's talking about growing up. I wrote this down where he was talking about school. Gym class was not my scene. You know.
I did, like, a weird, so I got my wisdom teeth out recently, and I did, like, a weird, just, like, hours long, like, research project on Mayor Pete for no real particular reason. I just,
citizenship, like, would be the reason?
Yeah, sure. And I think he's fascinated.
He is. Like, get this, so librarian.
Sweet. Yeah, ready.
He's talking about the Chrysler bailout during the early Obama administration. And he says, good policy, like good literature, takes personal lived experience as its starting point.
Oh, Mayor Pete. All right. Well, those are all of my questions. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For taking the time to sit down and talk with me. And we'll probably talk more about Mayor Pete once we get off. All right. Thanks.
We asked some readers to call in and tell us about their favorite books. Listen on for some of their responses.
Hi, my name is Evelyn, and my favorite nonfiction book is probably Under the Banner of Heaven by Jon Krakauer.
Hi, my name is Cecilia, and my favorite nonfiction book is The Inner Life of Animals by Peter Wolben.
Hi, my name's Tony. My favorite nonfiction book, I think my favorite nonfiction book would actually be King Leopold's Ghost. So that book chronicles the Belgian Congo and basically how King Leopold II of Belgium, Belgium didn't own it. He owned it himself personally. Like it was his own little tract of land. And the whole book goes through a narrative style. So it's like, it's pretty interesting. It unfolds almost like a you can't believe this is real sort of thing as opposed to a dry textbook. So really like that book.
For more AADL podcasts, visit aadl.org/podcasts. Thanks for listening.